ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys for your Friday. Bilateral T20 series underway between Australia and Pakistan. Australian women have a new captain. There is a whole lot to chop up in the cricketing world, as always. My name's Corbin Middlemass, and my podcast co-host is Ed Cowan, who is in Sydney. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well. I'm just so mindful that you've been burning the candle at both ends.
Yes.
And you get home from the tennis, and then the cricket's on, and you're like, oh, I better watch that, because I know old Teddy wouldn't have seen a ball. Good guess.
I must... You go to bed at like 8:30 every night, so I was sort of I got home at like after midnight or whatever it was from the tennis last night, and I thought, oh, here we go, Australia's playing. So I thought, look, I'll just watch a little bit. That's all I need to watch just before I go to bed. Sure enough, I'm there till like the end of the 20th over or whatever it turns out to be, and wide awake. I feel like I can't go to bed before 3, and I can't get up before like 10:30, 11 at the moment. So I'm in a weird kind of body clock due to the tennis, but hey, has its advantages. All of a sudden, here I am. Sinking my teeth into some bilateral T20 cricket, which I don't know if it's a warm-up for the World Cup. I don't know what this is. But luckily you're here because you'll be able to sort of make sense of all of it for me, I'm sure.
I don't know if I'm your guy, but I'm going to be your guy today.
Cool. All right. Let's get into it. So for the first time in 7 years, Pakistan have beaten Australia in a T20 international. You'd be thinking, 7 years? Gee, that's a long time. Well, they've played like 7 times in that period. So basically, they've snapped a 7-game losing skid against Australia in the format. A 22-run win. Adam Zampa was superb, which one part of it was awesome. Another part of it was Pakistan have a lot of spinners in their team. And we didn't really pick a whole lot of slow bowlers in our lineup. He took 4 for 24 off his 4 overs. Target was 169. And really, our guys struggled considerably with the slow bowlers. Abra, in particular, was awesome. He bowled 4 overs, Teddy, 2 for 10 with 17 dot balls, and our guys had very few answers for what he threw at them. Cam Green made 36, and then Xavier Bartlett, when the match was done, just slogged 34 at the end. He was not out, so 8 for 146. The boys fell 22 runs short. There's a whole lot of subplots to come out of it, but I think the biggest one is the fact that 5 of the 11, Teddy, aren't in the World Cup squad. So don't worry about being in the team. They're not in the 15. So this isn't really a sign of what's to come. There's a whole lot of guys here that are on the fringe of the lineup. There's a bunch of guys that are cooling their heels before the tournament proper. But what do you make of all that?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack. I'm glad you picked that up as the talking point, because it was the aside from the result where Australia got badly beaten, really. I think this is the one to kind of pick apart. So, you know, T20 more than any other format is a format that relies on clarity of role and cohesion of team. And we've seen the Australian team, you know, really perform well when both, you know, exist strongly together. And so when you're a week out from a tournament, literally 1 week out, and you play 3 games, and maybe they treat the pool games as warm-up games, and that's how this team rolls, and they know that they got to be at the pointy end and playing their best cricket then. But I would have thought three games a week out is a lovely time to just absolutely lock down every little plan, roll, you know, cross the I's and dot the T's, so you know your World Cup campaign is on track from day one. And so, you know, if I look through this team, I love seeing these names, by the way. So, you know, the Marley Beardman, Jack Edwards, you know, Matt Shorts, those types of players who will have big futures for Australia. But then I see what kind of role are they playing. And as you talked about, Pakistan went spin heavy. Australia's one kryptonite in this format of the game. And you would think in India there's a world where we will play, you know, maybe two specialist spinners, maybe with Cooper Conley doing as well as he is with the ball. He fits that role, and he did very well again last night. So it's about how teams line up, not just who they are. And the style of play is important. So it's, I guess, you know, you can argue it either way. The big boys need a rest. They've had a massive summer. You know, Cummins comes back in. Hazelwood hopefully comes back in. Ellis comes back in potentially, which is obviously a big if. And so the shape of the team looks totally different, and with it, the style of play. So maybe what my read-through is, and it's a long answer, is they actually don't care about these games.
Yeah.
Don't put them in the warm-up category. This is cobweb kind of dust-off for a few players like Adam Zampa, who hasn't played for a couple of weeks. And for the others, it's an opportunity to showcase their talents. Aside from that, put a full stop on it, and the next paragraph says World Cup.
Yep, I think you're bang on. So the team was 17-4 in their previous 21 games. So they've been in really good form in the format since the last World Cup. And I think you answered it where, you know, you look at the pool, for example, and the teams that Australia are playing. The pool stage is the old sort of warm-up game, isn't it, nowadays, that, you know, that they get the opportunity.
Particularly in the extended World Cups of the T20. Less so in the 50-over World Cup, but yes.
Yeah, but you get the chance to really get into the tournament at that stage. There are lots of question marks, and so they are going to have to just sort of throw it together and hope that it works once they get there. David and Ellis coming back from injury, which you said. Cummins and Hazelwood haven't played a whole lot, one of them at all. And then, you know, Maxwell's been out of form, so they'll have to try and find a way to make it work. The Matt Short role was interesting. So I felt like sort of it was either Matt Short or Mitch Olin who got that last spot in the World Cup squad. And in the end, they decided to go with Matt Short, and maybe it gives them another slow bowling option. Who knows? But I thought that if he is to play in the World Cup, he would be playing in the middle to lower order. That's kind of the role they would have earmarked for him. And yet last night when they get a warm-up game, he's there opening the batting. And I kind of felt like, to what end? Like, is it almost better off him, if he's going to play in, you know, six or seven in the lineup, is he better off batting there now as opposed to batting at one? And you just get Mitch Olin to do that as a stopgap, or put Phillippe up the top, or whatever it turns out to be. It sort of felt a little bit like he's not going to bat ahead of Marshall Head when the tournament proper starts. So what's the point of him batting at number one in a warm-up game?
Also, that's the case study of what I put forward, you know, the theory for. And that is, you know, this format is exactly about defining roles and clarity around that and opportunity to perform in that. So, you know, you articulated it perfectly. Why you don't swap those two around, and we don't need to labour the point, but Mitch Owen, by all means, has done, you know, well in the lower to middle order for Australia, but isn't in the World Cup squad. Matt Short, his opportunity most likely would come in that role in maybe a Maxwell swap out, for instance, if Maxwell continues to play the way he has been playing. Unlikely, but that's the kind of role that you could see him playing, barring other injury. And so why wouldn't you take that opportunity? You know, and too often we kind of say this in the modern construct of touring. We did it with England. And why wouldn't they do it? It makes kind of logical sense. And there's always these reasons in the background. We just never hear about them. So we kind of try and get some dots as to understand. So people think, oh, geez, they're being negative. We just don't know what the thinking is.
It's more a question. Yeah, it's, as you said, it's just an open-ended.
It doesn't make any, logically, to the outsider, the pub test is, well, that makes no sense.
Cam Green was involved in another run-out. Matt Renshaw was the man who got run-out on that occasion. And then Mitch Owen was the other man who was run-out. We had two in the innings in the top six, and that was a bit more unfortunate where the firmly struck ball back at the bowler came off his pinky and hit the stumps, and Mitch Owen was short of his ground at the non-striker's end. Josh Phillippe, so averages 12 at a strike rate of 108 now playing for Australia. He's played 16 matches, batted 14 times. And remembering his T20 international career started with, 90 runs in his first three hits. So that's responsible for his 172 runs. And then in his next 11 hits, he scored 82 runs with a best of 13. So he hasn't really been able to get going. I thought there was a good opportunity for him last night where, you know, he was batting at six or seven, which again is not his usual role, but team was four or five for not many. He knocked around a few and then unfortunately was out for a dozen.
It's amazing how his form comes in fits and spurts, and it's almost the next, the next evolution of his game is finding some kind of consistency because, you know, started the Big Bash okay, but really tapered very poorly towards the back end of the season, so came in with no confidence and no real conviction in how he was going to play, and it looked that way. So this is someone who you can't deny is talented. His best is international class, but he hasn't found it consistently enough to put pressure on the two big keepers in Carey and Inglis. And in this format, it's obviously Inglis. But it's a nice backup option because we know he can play. But I do I do feel like he comes in waves, and when he's hot, and when he's cold, he can get really cold. And he's not quite in the fridge yet, but he's certainly sitting on the bench.
And the problem that happens with these guys is, you know, you get a look in here and there, and you can say, oh, well, he hasn't had a prolonged run at it. Well, not everybody's international experience is, hey, here's 8 or 9 games, go and prove it. You know, often you do come in for 3 or 4 games at a time, and then all of a sudden you've played 12 to 16 games, and people look back and go, oh, hang on, he only averages 12. And you think, well, sometimes that's how the experience is, that when you do get an opportunity, even if it isn't a series like this where you go, look, there's not a whole lot of road in front of you, he's not part of the World Cup squad, he's not going to play there, but you got the opportunity now. Like, it's that's it, because otherwise you stack them all together and it makes for pretty lean reading.
Yeah, there's a very old adage in cricket: every innings is an opportunity, and it doesn't matter who you're playing for or against. You might be a state player playing club cricket or an international player playing state cricket. People are always watching, and your runs always count to some degree, because I know for a fact, and it was my experience, when you're not scoring runs, they say, oh, he's not scoring runs.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, but it's club cricket, and I'm a test cricket. They're like, we don't care, you're not scoring in club cricket. So, you know, that's a different example of this, because it's in reverse. But in T20 cricket, you know, the shorter formats more broadly, you go on these tours and you get opportunity. Not extended opportunity, it's kind of tour-specific opportunity. It's not like the test team where you know you're going to get 6 or 7 tests, but that's usually series-specific, but it takes 2 months, where these are done and dusted in a week. So it is an opportunity, and it's, you can only kind of walk off and kick yourself. And as you say, when you look up and you've played, you know, 20 games 20 times, if that makes sense, you've played your first game almost 20 times, you haven't compounded the learnings or got better or understood your role, and it's hard, then it's pretty hard to be aggrieved if they stop asking you to come on the tour. And it's a hard road back from there, particularly in this format, because you only really get one go at it a year via the Big Bash.
Do you know what was weird to see? Not just the very shades of green, which annoys me forever and a day in cricket, that we saw on full display last night when we had two green teams playing each other. And for whatever reason, the cricket manufacturers cannot nail this down, that we can never get everybody with the same shade of helmet, same shade of pads. I have no idea why it happens. It's dogged Pakistan for 40 years, and now that Australia are playing more cricket in green, we saw it last night. Everybody's got a different shade of green. Some people have olive pads, some people have bright green pads. I don't understand how it's that difficult that we can't get everybody to be uniform on this front. We seem to do it with white and cream and various other colours, red, yellow, blue. We cannot do it, Teddy, with green. What is it about the colour green?
Well, I actually think it's on brand for Pakistan. They've been doing it forever and a day, and it's part of, you know, the aesthetic of, you know, the hobbledy-cobbledy nature of how they play their cricket. You don't know if you're getting lime green or dark green one day, and that is the vibe that they kind of go with. The Australians, a little bit disappointing, but how it comes about often, not from a helmet point of view, different manufacturers, understand they should just kind of give the Pantone code and spray from there. But you can imagine how these pads are made. It's some worker in the back of a factory with a spray can or a, you know, in a machine, and they're doing it at the lowest cost for the, so it's not much thought goes into it. So unless the ICC clamp down and they say, we're going to fine you unless you're in your colour range, it ain't changing.
Here's a point. How about we just don't wear green? How about we just start there and we go back to wearing yellow, like we Aussie gold? I don't understand. Like, is anyone that wedded to the green? I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to wear green in the T20s and yellows in the 50 over stuff. But let's just get out of it to begin with. Go back to the grey. Remember when we wore grey and yellow?
I don't mind the black and yellow.
Yeah,
I hated the grey and yellow.
I like the grey. The grey was cool with the skins underneath. That was I didn't mind it, but. Okay. I'd get out of the green, maybe would be the first point.
Get out of the green.
The other thing which caught me off guard yesterday was Mitch Marsh, who had a great quote where basically the temperature's been very mild in Pakistan. It's their winter, so it's about 17, 18 degrees. And he essentially said, look, I didn't pack enough jumpers. He goes, I didn't realise Pakistan got this cold. And so basically all the boys are a little short on the appropriate gear. But I saw Mitch Marsh last night running out sort of drinks and gloves, wearing the high-low sort of high-vis running shirt as basically the 12th man or doing those duties for the Australian cricket team last night. And I thought, How is the captain of Australia in the T20 format doing that? I mean, Pat Cummins was at the Sydney Test. He wasn't out there running out gloves or whatever it turns out to be to the guys that weren't playing or whatever. I know why he wasn't playing. He's basically, I think they got on a plane on Tuesday and the game was on Thursday. But I thought if you're running gloves and it's a 20-over game, aren't you better off just going out there and having a hit like as opposed to doing that for the team? It was unusual to see the captain of the Australian cricket team sort of running drinks to, I think it was Josh Philippi and Xavier Bartlett in like the 16th over or something.
Unusual but awesome. It's a short shift rather than a test match being the 12th or 13th man. I'm quite happy to see him on the pine to make sure he's fit. There's the risk of injury within 48 hours of flying is dramatically increased. And so put your feet up, Mitch. You can play the third game if you like and come in hot for the World Cup. His cricket's purring at the moment.
And the last one is, everyone knows watching cricket in Pakistan, one of the great parts of it is the product placement. And I know we're the ABC, but if you haven't watched much cricket in that part of the world, honestly, the TV coverage is so good that the cutaways almost are like infomercials that happen in the middle of the cricket. It's so good. It's honestly as an ABC person saying that, but it's that the cheesy infomercials are sort of almost worth watching alone to see them handing out phones and then everyone having a selfie. It's brilliant. Brilliant. All right. Well, I think there's like three games in 4 days. So if you miss one, there'll be another one coming up very quickly.
So what time did it start for you last night?
Started at 10 p.m.
Oh, okay.
Which is like 4 o'clock.
I'll watch the next one.
4 o'clock local time. So
I'll get that one in.
There you go. Three games in 4 days. Thursday, Friday, that's tonight, and then another game on Sunday. So back-to-back nights and then one off and play the last game for whatever version of the Australian cricket team is out there at the moment. Just still on World Cup issues, I saw Mark Butcher's comments on Wisden talking about the T20 World Cup, and we discussed this last week, and we're a bit like, oh, I don't know how to feel about it. It didn't really leave a good taste in your mouth, the fact that obviously Bangladesh were punted from the tournament and Scotland took their place. He went on to say that, had a strong opinion on this, which I haven't seen sort of too many, basically saying that the ICC and the governing bodies, which voted, I think, 14-2 in favour of Bangladesh being put out of the tournament, that it's nobody else's problem but yours. Basically saying this was the right decision from the ICC. He said it must be resolved in this manner. If you can't fulfil your obligations, whether that's nationalistic pressure, political pressure, religious reasons, whatever it turns out to be, the competition goes on without you. And that basically this is the stance that they should be taking. We shouldn't be bending and weaving to all sorts of governing bodies or whatever about trying to make the tournament happen. This is pro sport. This is how it happens. Sort it out. That the problem's at the feet of Bangladesh. What do you make of that position?
Well, I love hearing commentators and analysts actually take a view and not sitting on the fence. And the reason why we sat on the fence was I didn't feel like I had enough information. You probably felt the same. And so my overriding emotion is one of sadness that it got to that point, not whether it was right or wrong. And so it's nice to hear. I love hearing the various views as to why it should or shouldn't happen. And as long as you're mindful of the incentives of those people who are making those comments and where they work and who they work for and when they work for them, it's always interesting to hear. So, I mean, that's a valid view.
Yeah.
It's hard to pick holes in that as a view.
Yep.
I'm still undecided whether I agree in that view. I just don't know enough.
Yep. I think it completely makes sense. I mean, rather than sort of bending to political pressure, because it's like the thin edge of the wedge thing, isn't it? And I think that's what people feel like's been created with the whole India-Pakistan relationship. But, once we start doing that for a third time and a fourth time and whatever it turns out to be, that... it's a slippery slope. He also raised the question as to why Scotland got the call up. So Scotland were the next highest ranked team, so they come in. I don't know if that's a matter of the fact that they're a pretty well organised associate nation. They can get something together on a short notice. Given the fact that they do have qualifiers for the World Cup and Scotland finished last in their pool, they lost to Jersey, who are actually the next highest, they were the next highest seed out of the qualifying process. So whether you lean on the qualifying process or you lean on the rankings, and his point was, if we're going to lean on the rankings, why do we have the qualifiers to begin with? We may as well just pick the next highest seed or whatever, and they come in as they have done in this scenario.
So that is something I do have a view on, and I totally agree with him. There is, if you're going to have a qualifier, you go to the next qualifier, because we know these rankings are not worth the internet browser they're printed on.
Yep. And we
couldn't agree with that more. I mean, it's kind of hard to fathom. Oh, Jersey over Scotland. Well, hang on. Last time Jersey played Scotland, they gave him a touch-up.
Just on some of the squads that's just starting to come through. So no Rizwan, no Harris Ralph, despite his dominant big bash for Pakistan. So they're out of those teams. We'll do a bit more of a deep dive of this in the episodes to come as we get closer to the start of the tournament. Joe Root's piling off runs in every format he's playing at the moment, in the Test arena and then now in the ODIs. Harry Brook was asked about whether he was in the mix. Brook's response was he's not quite in the mix, so he won't be there in the T20 team for England, Joe Root. And then India, as we already know, have dropped their test and ODI captain Shubman Gill, so that's a pretty tough team to get into, and he won't be part of it. So some big-name players, or at least long-time established players, no longer in the best 11 for, or best 15 in this case, in their T20 teams. They won't be part of the tournament. Just while we're still on T20 cricket, I got some feedback from Cricket Australia regarding my comments the other day about the TV ratings.
Nice of them to be listening. So we get feedback on team selections. We get feedback on, was it a fact check?
It was a little bit, yeah. That's just along the lines of,
yeah. We like correction. If you were wrong, I'd like to hear it.
As you can imagine, people at Cricket Australia follow the TV ratings very closely, as you would. I mean, that's their bread and butter and everything else. The numbers that I quoted last week basically saying, hey, the tennis has edged out. The cricket was basically the linear TV numbers when it comes to 7 versus 9. But what I didn't factor in all of that is obviously our good friends at Fox Sports. So if you put the Fox cricket number on top, when you add in our Fox cricket audiences, it's around 30% more. So all up, we did around 1.4 average compared to the tennis, which did 1.1. So basically making the argument that the final beat the tennis the other night. And in fact, all the finals outrated the tennis by the same measure, barring the rain-affected game between the Hurricanes and the Stars, which you can imagine, bit stop start, people move across and everything else. So just wanted to clear that up. But the TV numbers, it's hotly debated, and there's obviously, you bring in pay TV, then there's streaming numbers is a whole other conversation. You know, there'll be people on the tennis side of the fence saying, oh, but what about the people watching on, Stan and Nine and everything else? And people in cricket will be saying, yeah, but then there's KO and 7+ and everything else. So just wanted to put that out there to if I sort of led people astray the other day with my 7v9 comparison on free-to-air.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always, as soon as any, and this is X, this kind of conversation, any sports organization starts talking about broadcast numbers or participation numbers, they usually find a way to make sure that they are at the top of that rankings. In this case, it is only, we're talking about a co-broadcaster in Fox, be it through the cable or, with the cord cut via KO. And so they're genuine numbers. That is now a like-for-like, I think. I'm sure tennis's numbers would have come up as well, but they don't have two broadcasts. They've got one.
Yeah.
So you can imagine there's no way that 30% of their viewership would have been done via any other platform, really.
Hey, hats off to we're cricket people. Hats off to cricket. Another dub for us.
I love it. It's a win. It caught me off guard when you said it, to be honest. I was thinking, it's like a round of 16 game of tennis. Well, what's happening?
Hmm. But going back a couple of years though, the tennis would routinely beat the Big Bash. So, Big Bash is on the up and up. Don't worry about that. What else was I going to ask you about? I was going to talk about the window, obviously, that is needs to be created. We spoke a bit about this last week where Todd Greenberg sort of ducked and weaved the question from Sam Perry on the grade cricketer about what happens with that window in January. And I saw some questions being put around during the week basically saying the other way, that should the test summer be extended longer? What should happen in the January window? Should the New Year's test disappear completely? What do you think happens when we actually get to that stage? What will they do in that January window? Will that be Big Bash? Will it be more test matches? Where's the landing spot, do you think, eventually, if the privatisation goes through of the BBL teams?
I've seen lots of different variations to this. I think the one that if and we're still kind of in this fantasy land of privatisation, for the record. So, we're just kind of hypothesising. It basically is a window from, call it Christmas, through to a week later, essentially, and the January test holds. That is, by all measures, a very, very successful test match. And to move it, I think, is... Personally, I think is a mistake, and I think other people think that as well. So
Yep.
I think that's probably the most likely outcome. Rather than having a fully clear January, you clear the back end from other forms of calendar and kind of run it an extra week.
There would be something cool about launching it on New Year's Eve, though. Like, imagine if you could have...
What about launching it on Christmas Eve?
No? Well, we got a pretty good game on the 26th that starts, so that's that makes it hard. But all these things, I'm sure, will be kicked around. And yet, Todd Greenberg said multiple times to his credit that the Boxing Day and the New Year's Test aren't going anywhere. So the one thing that it feels like he's absolutely locked into is that the Melbourne and Sydney Test matches will stay where they are.
What about, that does remind me of your comrade in broadcasting somewhat, Jared Waitley, who is talking up every second year that Sydney should host a test and it should alternate with Hobart.
I hadn't heard that. Yeah. No, you're not a fan of that? You're a Sydney and Hobart person?
Yeah, well, hang on.
We can call it the Ed Cowan test.
They should probably alternate the Boxing Day test with Monica as well. I mean, why not? Hey. While we're doing it.
The one thing I know you're a big fan of is the player movement window in the BBL. Free agents.
For my fantasy, I'm already starting to play on my fantasy team next year.
Free agents are plenty in the competition. We know that Glenn Maxwell's decided to stay, so he signed a 2-year extension with the Melbourne Stars. I saw it reported that Adam Zampa wants to play somewhere a little bit closer to his home in Byron, and so the two teams they threw forward were the Thunder and the Sixers. And then I got out my map, and I thought
the Brisbane Heat.
Hang on, the Brisbane Heat's like an hour and a half away. I was like, I would have thought that would be the landing spot, but anyway, Matt Kuhneman's got some interest from the Hurricanes, where of course he's been playing domestic cricket for Tasmania. He's also most likely to stay with the Heat, such as the reporting on this front. Likewise, Michael Nisa, who's expected to stay. Josh Inglis's name's been thrown around, but again, you'd think the Scorchers would have had a mare if they let him go. Todd Murphy's an interesting one, who's off contract, so the Renegades and the Stars naturally of interest there, given the fact that he plays his domestic cricket for Victoria. But I've just picked out a few little names here that if I was a BBL GM and I was looking to moneyball as best I can, Teddy, and try and go and get a few players that might be underpriced to see what I can do with them. So I've picked out a few names here, and you tell me if I'm barking up the wrong tree or not. Tim Ward from the Hurricanes, who's off contract. This stylish player, can whack him.
Great fielder, great hair.
Yeah. So,
It just depends. I mean, the whole point of moneyball is undervalued, so I have no idea what the Hurricanes currently pay him. But I think in terms of, so what's the bucket we're putting all these players in is you're making a bet that in 3 years' time they are significantly better players than they are at this point in time, with more opportunity at a different club. So I'd put Tim Ward in that bucket all day, every day.
All right, here's some other guys I'm looking at. Blake McDonald for the Stars. So got.
I think he's kind of where he needs to be. He's a nice little player.
Sam Fanning for the Perth Scorchers.
Excellent cricketer. I would put him in the speculative buy bucket for sure. That's real money ball, that one.
Can go, bats in the top three. Yep. Nick Hobson, if we're looking for someone that can bat 6-7 in the lineup, so he's like your closer, sort of John Wells role that we've had for years.
Seller,
not interested there. Todd Murphy?
Yeah, it depends on your list construction. I think he's an excellent cricketer. I'd still love him to stay at the Sixers for obvious reasons.
I mean, the media story narrative one is Harjus Singh. I mean, clearly he's, we saw him whack him in Sydney grade cricket and everything else, and would obviously love to see him get an opportunity.
He'll get picked up and be given an opportunity, and we'll see. But that's in the Moneyball bucket.
And the last one, we're talking about, multi-year deals and everything else for guys. So particularly the Australian brand name players here. So you think about guys like Nathan Lyon and Scott Boland, these blokes that get multi-year deals, never end up playing a game for their BBL team. If I'm looking at one national player, one guy that's, brand name, high profile, and I would quite happily take a risk that for the next 3 or 4 years, I'll have him in T20 cricket, it'd be Josh Hazlewood for me. Because I'd be banking on the fact that, in the short term, probably not. Like, next year, the team's going to India, all the rest of it. You think how much T20 cricket he's going to play for your franchise next year. But I'm banking on, in a couple of years' time, he's playing the best cricket of his T20 career right now. I think he can do it at an advanced age. If he ends up sort of just playing that and plays less of the other formats, then you might just get bang for your buck on the back end compared to these other guys that you'll probably rarely see.
So I love the theory. You'd want to be pretty quietly confident on a multi-year deal that he was aligned to some kind of slide on the other formats, because there's a world where he actually goes the other way and says, I'm going to prioritise test cricket and, yeah, I'll take your money, but...
He's got to bowl four overs.
I understand that, but... So I love the theory. While we're talking about player movement, you're right in a sense that this year there aren't many free agents. My understanding is next year is going to be a bit of a bonanza.
Okay.
Lots of people are coming up. And in line with that, I'm hearing from a couple of players that they're going to scrap the international draft. And, you know, we've talked about this before, in that if you're the best domestic player, you're kind of capped from a salary cap point of view as to what people can be paid. And then you look across and they have a minimum payment for your bronze, silver or gold and platinum player that are now tier three players, really. They do a job. But they're not world beaters, and nor are they people that are putting bums on seats. So your best Australian cricketer that is going to play every game, let's put Josh Inglis in that bucket, might play test cricket, but kind of a bit furry. He's more of an attraction than pick your international.
Yeah.
They have a guaranteed price, and Josh is probably below that. And so you get rid of the draft and you say, we'll go direct. There's a market rate for every international player. And so, yes, we're not going to compete with the ILT in the Emirates. But guess what? David Payne ain't playing over there. And if he does, and they want to pay him big money, good luck to him. So, you know, your average international wage comes down and it allows you to actually pay your best domestic players more.
Mm. When do you think they'll get to a point? So say they're planning on doing the privatisation thing, which, as we know, a lot of water's got to go under the bridge year after next. When does it get to a point where you think, guys, hang on, we need to stop signing guys to multi-year deals here, knowing that the whole market's going to change? Like, if you're an agent, I'd be like, guys, one-year deals, let's just wait and see what happens here.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't see it necessarily going like that, even once it is.
Right.
Because they're not fully independent franchise. And if a state owns 51%, you want to be producing and being able to enjoy the fruits of your labour when it comes to your best players. So I don't think the states would agree to a super draft in terms of everyone just goes in and you can pick who you want. I find that hard to believe in the short term.
Yeah, I think it'd be great for the game. Talk about the draft. Like, I'm not watching the international draft, but I'm watching a super draft. Like, if all of a sudden everyone's in
it. So it's interesting.
So we got
for the layperson. I don't think it's interesting as a board of director on the board of directors of Cricket South Wales, thinking our best player could be playing for Perth, and we can't stop that from happening.
But you asked a question the other day about, you know, what do we do about equalisation in this competition? Well, there's no better way to equalise than to blow everything up and start again.
Couldn't agree with you more. So, and maybe there's a method where you get a right of refusal if they're a local player, whatever that is. And
keep six and everyone else goes in.
That's it. Exactly. So there's some spectrum in there that you can kind of analyse.
Well, that's how it was sold to me. I mean, when I was seeing our Warriors disappear and our Bushrangers and our Redbacks and all these other teams back in the days, it was going to be, but it's going to be a franchise league and everyone can play for everyone else. And then all of a sudden it was, you know, reincarnated and it was basically the Warriors who are now wearing orange and it's all the same guys from WA. And you think, you know, it's nothing ever really changed. Like, there's the odd player here or there that plays in a different market, but the whole idea was meant to be anyone can go anywhere. It's, you know, it's chaos for... you know, 5 to 6 weeks or whatever, and you're all in different parts of the country, like in the AFL, for example, where they do play in all different ports, that the pull to play at home and in your home city is still as strong as it ever has been in domestic cricket.
Yeah.
The other big news of the week is that Sophie Molyneux is the new Australian women's captain. So congratulations to Sophie. Great story out of Bairnsdale, which is a country town in Gippsland. She leapfrogged, must be said, Tali McGrath and Ash Gardner to become the ninth T20 international captain. She'll do that when the team plays at the SCG on February the 15th. She's played 58 matches for Australia since her debut as a 20-year-old back in 2018, which is 8 years ago now. She's had serious shoulder, knee and foot injuries. She returned from a knee injury to feature at the ODI World Cup last October and captained the Renegades from as early as the age of 21. So she'll take over from Elisa Healy as the full-time Australian women's captain. Congratulations firstly to her.
Yeah, I mean, when you start reading on cricket.com.au that, you know, she's in the mix, usually there are rumblings that kind of surface. That's almost like a soft sound. If you know, that happens quite a bit as well. So when I read that maybe a week or so ago, it kind of caught my eye because she wasn't on my radar, but I'm not close enough to the team to know who the true leaders are.
No, but it was so out of the blue that you felt like, oh, this is on. Like, it's sort of like, why else would her name be in the mix? Yeah.
It was a full soft sound because on paper and the games that I do watch, I see Gardner, I see Litchfield, I see McGrath, and then I see a gap, and then, you know, a fine cricketer, and maybe she's going to be a fine captain and the best person for the job. I have no kind of education just because I haven't had the exposure to the members of the team enough.
Yep. Someone's going to have to explain the Ash Gardner being overlooked to me. And I don't mean like someone gives me a call and briefs me off the record or whatever about it. I mean, like, I want to hear why in a head-to-head they went the way that they did. And
I don't think you're ever going to get that around a captaincy decision.
And certainly they weren't going to get asked in the same way the other day. I thought the way the press conference rolled out where, you know, Todd's there with Sean Flegler, the head of selectors, and then Sophie's there. I mean, if you're the press, you're not really, like, it's a great moment for Sophie. You're not really going to then grill people as to how come she got it and someone else didn't or whatever it turns out to be. So I get the
why
tally.
Why don't you ask for Sean Flegler for your Saturday?
Because I'm not on at the moment because I'm doing the tennis.
Yeah, but what about next Saturday?
He's welcome to come on our pod. We're on every Monday and Friday. We don't ordinarily have guests, but people welcome all the time.
I actually think we should maybe make Friday, we start doing some guests.
Yep.
What do you think? Can we pitch that?
Yep.
You ask the questions. You play bad cop, I'll play good cop.
We can. But I think particularly when it comes around selection, like we've said that all the time. We ask a lot of questions here, and I know people get very, people get rabbit ears about it. So when it comes to any kind of selection or admin issue, write a reply all the time. Always welcome here on the ABC Cricket Podcast if you want to come on.
We love rigorous debate. We're happy to be wrong.
That's what we're all about. And
always wrong.
This is what we talk about.
Torches. They won it this year.
Correct.
Who would have picked that?
This is what we talk about all the time when it comes to the selection of the men's team. Like, at the end of the day, like, who knows more about cricket? Is it Andrew McDonald and George Bailey, or is it like me, the sports guy who works on the radio? Like, at the end of the day, like, I'm pretty sure, like, we know who's going to know a bit more about cricket. We ask questions. We're always looking for answers on that front, and more often than not, I'm sure they got them. But when it comes to Sophie, so I understand why she could edge out, for example, Tali McGrath. Like, Tali McGrath's 30. She's in the worst form slump of her career right now. It's hard to lead from a marginal position. I get why, for example, you know, her next step's almost falling out of the team. It's not captaining the side. So let's put Tali McGrath to one side. The woman who's been her deputy for large periods has been Ash Gardner. So they've elevated Gardner to a captaincy position, to a leadership position. So immediately, that's a step that they've taken to say, hey, we feel like she's a future leader of this team. At 28, she's the exact same age. She has won, I think, two of the last four Belinda Clark medals and been runner-up in another. So she's been like a top two player for a four-year period. She is in the peak of her cricketing power over the last 4 years. She's in her prime. And while she's been doing that, Sophie Molyneux hasn't played a T20 international since October 2024. She hasn't played a test match since February 2024. We're in 2026 now. So that's 2 years ago since she's played a test match. It's been, 15 months since she's played a T20 international, and she has played four ODIs, which were in October 2025. So the only time that we've seen her in national colours for 15 months has been to play four matches on injury load restrictions coming back at that World Cup. She played four of a possible seven matches. That's the only time we've seen her in 15 months. And she edges out Ash Gardner, who has been, you know, the premier player during that period of time across all formats.
That is a pretty good. I love that you brought the data to the table. That's a pretty rock solid argument that I can't refute, really. I mean, it caught me off guard, and I hadn't done the work as to what that actually looks like. What I do know is Ash Gardner has been considered a great leader for a long time, and the elevation spoke to that, as did her captaining the Sixers this year. That was intentional.
Yeah, you know,
that was she will most likely be the next captain of Australia, and let's give her as much opportunity to shine as possible. So as long as it's been communicated to her, I don't really, I know as the journalist inside, you want the answers, but as long as it's been clear with her as to the reason, because the worst case for this team is it impacts her form. So you've now got your best player who's disenfranchised, losing interest, whatever, pick your adjective, and her performances follow that emotion, then this team, when it should be, you know, at a point of actually winning tournaments still, which they've they've struggled in recent times, they should be the best team in the world, without doubt.
Yeah, and I'm not saying this is the case, but I think there's a whole lot of other set of questions that go along with it, particularly when this takes place. I mean, Ash has been outspoken on various social issues in the past. Cricket Australia have always seemingly really supported her on that front. And yet when it's time for her to be the spokesperson and the voice piece for the organisation, it goes in a different direction to someone that we've barely seen for 15 months, which is as great as Sophie's been, there are so many layers to it and everything else. And I wish Sophie all the best. She's a great player. I love watching her play.
Lovely person.
But her issue's been she hasn't been able to play continuous cricket. And while that's been happening, another woman's come along and taken the mantle as the premier player. We've seen that in the way that, they've elevated her to leadership positions recently. The way that she's been voted, by her, people that vote on the Belinda Clark medal and everything else, which are often her coaches and the selectors and everything else. So, and yet, for whatever reason, when this comes up, and I guess that's the bit that I'm looking for, is what is the reason? What's the reason as to why it goes in a different direction?
Honestly, that could be one of your finest moments. That was beautifully articulated. But you can clip that up. You know when the sports awards come up and they say, send us a clip of some of your best work. Just send them that. That was excellent, Corbin.
Anyway, you're right. The point that you make is actually the most salient one. That as long as she's got a pretty good understanding, you don't want this something that because it is a left field appointment in a team that felt like it had many name brand players and now they've got a captain who hasn't really been on the scene.
And it's hard for her to come into the team just before we put a full stop on this, to come in, perform and captain. And so that's always the risk when you pick a captain who isn't one of your first three picked. And so we'll see where it lands.
That was my reason for basically saying I understand why it's not Tali McGrath. Hard to lead from a marginal position. Anyway, we'll see what happens. They play India coming up in a multi-format series. Teddy, thank you to you. I think we're just about... Have I missed anything? Oh, Jason Gillespie, our man, is off to coach Hyderabad in the PSL, one of the new franchises.
Wow. He's allowed back in the country.
Apparently, he's off. He's going back to play to coach over there. Luke Ronchi's going to lead the other team, which is Islamabad United. So for the upcoming PSL, so good luck to our man Dizzy over there.
See you Monday.
Sounds good. I'll see you then.
Later.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.